The Kings of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, Persepolis, Part 2. For the moment, Alexander reserved the royal precinct for himself, and there he sat on another of Darius's thrones. Plutarch claims that this sight, Demetrius of Corinth, burst into tears, as old men will, and declared that those Hellens were deprived of the great pleasure who had died before seeing Alexander seated on the throne of Darius. For many, taking the city seemed the happy culmination of the great war of vengeance, or at least showed that the ultimate victory must be close. Babylon's monuments were magnificent and of great antiquity, stretching back long before the Persian Empire. But at Persepolis, everything was designed to celebrate the Achaemenids, built on a rock terrace to be higher than the city, which was primarily there to support the court when the king was in residence, and surrounded by a high wall, the royal compound was divided into three main ceremonial sections: the Apadana, the audience hall, the throne room, and the treasury, with palaces including a complex set aside for the royal harem. Visitors entered through one of the great gates and climbed a wide stairway to the terrace, past reliefs depicting the nations of the empire coming to pay homage and offer tribute. The diversity of the king's subjects was emphasized. Each with their distinct dress and sculpted soldiers showed Medes as well as Persians. Persepolis was far, far larger and grander than the Aegea or Pella, indeed than anything in the Greek world. Much of it was mud brick rather than stone, but the walls were high, the great halls roofed by cedar beams held up by row after row of pillars. Colors were bright, decoration elaborate in its detail, no doubt reinforced by the richness of the tapestries, furnishings, and bright clothes of the attendants, courtiers, and visitors who thronged the place during the great ceremonies. Yet the overwhelming impression was deliberately one of sheer scale, constantly reminding any visitors that they were tiny and insignificant compared to the majesty of the king whose halls these were. Everything was vast, and when Alexander's men went into the treasury, they're supposed to have found 120,000 talents in gold and silver, apart from all the other precious things. There were also immense quantities of stored weapons, especially arrows and spears, forged from bronze as well as iron. By the 4th century BCE, Persepolis appears to have only had a secondary administrative role in running the empire, and looks as if its treasury was a reserve, rarely if ever touched, and instead housing the annual tribute brought from all over the empire. The great king's power was underlined by the simple fact that he didn't need to call upon his wealth, nor did he spend that much time at Persepolis, instead ruling from Susa or Ecbatana, the capital of Media, and conveniently placed to supervise the eastern satrapies. Persepolis proclaimed the strength of the Achaemenid kings and their right to rule as representatives of the Zoroastrian god Ahura Mazda. And in the emphasis of the great variety of his subjects, the Persian acceptance of local traditions and religion as long as subject people remained loyal and subservient. It is hard to say how much Alexander the Macedonian or Greek understood this and of the empire's function. They could certainly see the splendor and fabulous wealth, as well as the simple truth that Alexander now sat on Darius's throne, occupied his palaces and ceremonial halls, and possessed his treasures, while the great king of kings was a fugitive somewhere to the east. Even after Babylon and Susa and all the victories of the last few years, the knowledge can only have been intoxicating. The problem was what to do with it all. Persepolis was important because it was a symbolic heart of Persia, and the Persian and their kings were overlords of the empire. Nearby was Pasdagarde, capital before the far grander Persepolis was built. Alexander paid a visit, ordered the removal of these 6,000 talents in its treasury, while paying respect to the tomb of Cyrus, the founder of the dynasty. This may well have been genuine, as well as inviting contrast between the heroic first Achaemenid and the weak Darius III. His attitude towards other Persian kings and their symbols of power was far less enthusiastic, and he is supposed to have pondered raising a fallen statue of Xerxes on the basis that it had been just a king apart from his attack on Greece. After a while, Alexander moved on and the statue remained in the dust. From the start, it was clear Persepolis had no place in the regime that Alexander wished to create. He ordered the treasury to be emptied, and the wealth transported to Susa and subsequently to Ecbatana. This was a huge task, for the coin and bullion alone weighed over 7,000 tons, and Plutarch says 10,000 pairs of mules and 3,000 pack camels had to be brought to Persepolis. Gathering the transport took time, as did collecting and packing the treasure and escorting it on the journey, so this was one reason why the army stayed at Persepolis. The difficulty of supply during the winter months was another reason, especially when so much of the available logistic support was being used to move the treasure. But Alexander was not wholly idle, and he took a column out on a month's punitive expedition against the Mardi living in the southern reaches of the Zagros Mountains. There was little organized resistance, but conditions were harsh, and the operation may have helped to introduce some of the reinforcements to the rigors of the campaigning, as well as satisfy the king's relentless spirit. Now we're going to come into the point of real contention. What actually happened to the city? Because the ancient section where the palace is located was burned to the ground, or at least burned, and most of the city destroyed. So we're going to look at the different scenarios of how that happened next time. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arrians, The Campaigns of Alexander, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood, The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.